Penguin Random House Audio presents The Violin Conspiracy by Brendan Slocum. Read for you by J.D. Jackson. With a note read by the author.
To my youngest brother, Kevin B. Slocum, my hero for more reasons than I could ever count.
Part 1. The Disappearance. Chapter 1. Day 1. White Chucks, size 10 1/2. On the morning of the worst, most earth-shattering day of Ray McMillan's life, he ordered room service. Scrambled eggs for two, one side of regular bacon for Nicole, one side of vegan sausage for him, one coffee for Nicole, one orange juice for him. Later, he would try to second-guess those choices and 1,000 others that, in hindsight, vibrated in his memory. What if he'd ordered French toast instead of eggs? What if grapefruit juice instead of orange? What if no juice at all? Breakfast had materialized before he'd gotten out of the shower. He'd lost track of time, caught up in the fingering of the Tchaikovsky Concerto's triple stops, and water sluiced down for 10 minutes, while he gaped at the tiny bar of hotel soap. When he'd walked naked out of the bathroom, the aroma of bacon wreathed the suite. The breakfast tray was waiting on the tiny dining table, the dish's lid still in place. "I didn't even hear them come in," he said. If only every morning room service could magically deliver eggs and sausage. Nicole was curled up in one of the armchairs watching CNN. She twisted and untwisted a lock of auburn hair, the eighth note tattoo above her wrist rhythmically flickering and disappearing. "You never hear anything." "Another bombing in Jerusalem, and a hurricane bearing down on Indonesia." "I have a confession," she said, not looking away from the TV. "What did you do this time?" She wasn't looking at him, so he took a giant step forward and blocked her view of Indonesia. Gave her something else to look at. "I stole $5 from your wallet to tip her. Hope that was okay." She eyed his nakedness. "You're gonna eat like that?" "Do I need clothes to eat?" He leered at her. "This definitely works for me," she said. "I was just trying to figure out if you were going to get dressed now, or if you want to eat, or... We need to be out of here within an hour. You need to finish packing." "I'm already packed," she said. "You're the snail in this race." Ray slid on underwear and a t-shirt, grabbed a plate of food, lay back on the messed up bed. He propped the plate on his stomach. Afterward, he relived all the other choices of the morning, cluelessly packing his suitcase, scouring the suite one more time, pulling up his roller bag's handle. He slung the violin case over his right shoulder. Should he have put it on the left? Gestured for Nicole to go first with her two roller bags. The door clicked shut behind them, sealing the suite and what remained inside. Down the elevator, through the Saint-Jacques lobby, checking out, tipping the doorman who flagged down a cab for each of them. Nicole's first to Penn Station. He hefted her suitcases into the trunk, leaving his own roller bag on the sidewalk, the violin case slung securely on his shoulder. She turned to him, pressed her hand against his chest. Her warmth spread through his shirt, her touch like pizzicato, plucking violin strings with fingers he could feel shudder down his spine.
"I meant to tell you," she said. "When you're playing the Mozart, I think you're playing the second movement too fast. Just try taking it maybe 2 clicks slower. Really milk it."
"You think?" "Because Ben Amundsen said to keep the tempo bright."
"I know, but you play so much more passionately when it's a little slower. Just a little. Try it, all right? For me?"
New York battered against them, cars zooming past, splashing last night's rain onto the curb.
"Just come to Charlotte. Find a sub," he said. "You come to Erie," she said. "You know I have to practice. You can practice just as easily in Erie."
"I can't. There's Janice, there's my space. You know I..." She grabbed his head with both her hands, pulled him toward her and leaned forward so their foreheads touched. He closed his eyes, breathed her in.
"I'll see you next week," he said. "You've got this. Rayquan McMillan, future Tchaikovsky competition gold medalist. Just focus. Visualize it. You can totally do this, you know that? It's going to happen."
Another breath he could feel deep in his abdomen. He tilted forward to kiss her. A voice from the cab.
"Hey, buddy, you almost done there?"
Another moment ruined by New York City's transportation system. Before he could kiss her, before he could even say, "Call me when you get in," she jumped into the back seat and the taxi door slammed, and he stood there like an idiot as the car moved off into traffic. But already the day was hammering at him. His taxi had rolled up, trunk popping open, and he was spilling into the back seat with the violin, his anxiety level rising again. He wanted to be through LaGuardia back in Charlotte. This morning he hadn't even practiced his music, so now he was itching to pick up his violin, assure himself that he could really make Tchaikovsky's voice his own. Only 1 month left until the competition began. The world's most prestigious, most difficult classical music competition, judged by the top musicians in the world, as well as an online audience of millions of listeners. Even if he practiced every day, 14 hours a day, he didn't think he'd be ready. He resented wasting the time to fly home. At the airport, he filed into the TSA pre-check line. Had he only gone through regular security? Why had he been in such a hurry? He should have waited in the long queue. If he'd waited, the screener might have randomly pulled his suitcase aside or asked him to open the violin case. Someone would have noticed or asked. It was security, after all. Instead, he placed the roller bag on the conveyor belt, violin case behind it, and they sailed through the X-ray, and he sailed through the body scan, oblivious. Later, over and over, he replayed in his mind the next 2 hours. Boarding Delta Flight 457, stowing his luggage, the violin case could manspread alone in the overhead bin. Returning to Charlotte, home to his little house, the air musty and stale. He lay down on his bed for half an hour, grateful to be back, violin case on the floor next to him, where he always set it. He let the travel wash itself from his skin into the air, felt himself getting centered, getting focused, ready to play. It was just after 2 p.m. on May 16th when he kicked himself off the bed. He stood up, took 3 strides across the room, picked up the violin case, and set it on his bureau. He flicked open the left clasp, then the right, and the lid lifted back. His violin was gone. Inside sat a white tennis shoe, a Converse Chuck Taylor All-Star high-top canvas shoe, men's, size 10 and a half.
Ray wore a size 12. Poking out of the shoe's mouth like an obscene tongue, a sheet of white office paper folded in thirds. He unfolded it. Send $5 million in Bitcoin from BISC to wallet 34U69 AAV 89872. Transfer on July 15th between 12 p.m. Eastern Standard Time and 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You will receive no further communication. Chapter 2. Day 1. Darkness. The next few hours were a blur, and all that he could remember afterward was how he'd repeatedly opened and closed the violin case. Every time he was absolutely certain, absolutely convinced, that if he opened the case one more time, this time, the violin would be there, glowing, its tiger stripes shimmering like flames. Because how could it not be there? Instead, the obscenity of its empty mouth yawned back at him. Its barrenness was impossible, as if water were no longer wet. He'd called the Charlotte police, and none of it made sense. He was calling to say that the violin was stolen. But of course it wasn't stolen. It was right in its case where it belonged. The house was filled with uniforms and pale faces turning toward him, and then they were taking the violin case away from him. How could they take it away from him? And for moments at a time, he forgot how to breathe, as if the air had suddenly become something difficult and foreign. He was talking to New York police and the FBI, and then he was on another Delta plane back to New York, and it was impossible, because the violin was not on his shoulder and was not within arm's reach, and he couldn't touch it. Its absence gaped on his back, where the case should have been slung. The violin's absence was like nothing he'd ever felt before. He could tell you the exact pressure that he should feel, that he should be feeling, of it against his jaw, knew the flare of its ribs the way he knew the flare of his own. His thumb should rest against its neck, right where the wood darkened at the seam. The smooth roundness of its back was lit with orange and gold and brown, but those were words and couldn't touch the reality of how the pattern rippled and called out to him in a voice that only he could hear. How could anyone say it was just a violin? When he arrived back at the Saint-Jacques, the hotel clerk, the skinny blonde who'd been so rude to him last year so long ago that first day, put him up in another suite on the same floor as his and Nicole's previous suite. The police were in his old room, but they wouldn't let him in. He wanted to show them exactly where he'd stood, where the violin case had rested, but the crime scene crew was dusting and measuring and keeping him out. It didn't matter. The room had already been sanitized for the next guest. All the irreplaceable, priceless forensic evidence vacuumed, Windexed, bleached away. He stood for a while outside the room, looking in, and then found himself back in this new alien suite. He had no violin case, which was just insane, because of course always near him was a violin case and a violin inside. People, detectives, the hotel manager, the concierge, even Mike the doorman, would appear in the doorway to take Ray's fingerprints or to ask an apparently random question. Did he have it in the elevator? Was he sure the housekeeper left with the breakfast card? Over and over, he repeated his story, every detail, practicing the afternoon before. Dinner, drinks, back to the hotel, sleep, shower, breakfast, orange juice, flight. There were Delta Airlines representatives. There were agents from the FBI art crime team. Ray hadn't known that an art crime team even existed. He couldn't keep anyone straight, and didn't bother trying. He tried not to snap at them. They were here to help. He tried to breathe, but his ribs had been wrapped in piano wire. He tried to remain calm. He tried very hard not to cry. "I'm telling you," he kept telling them, "it was either my family or the Marx family. It had to be one of them. Go check them out." His words seemed to disappear into the air, to vanish unheard. We hear you, sir, said a NYPD detective, a fit-muscled guy with cheekbones that looked sharp enough to puncture the skin. I assure you we're looking into it. We just want to get more information about your own movements, yours and your girlfriend's. When did you say she was coming back? When was Nicole coming back? Ray couldn't remember. His hands were trying to hold on to something that wasn't there. It was gone. Of course it was gone. How could he have imagined that he could have kept it? That he was worthy? Everything that everyone had ever thought about Ray, about people who looked like Ray, was now turning into reality with an inevitability that he almost welcomed. It was so expected. He was bringing their words to life. He was exactly what they said he was. Incompetent. Irresponsible. It was all true, true, true. He not only wasn't good enough, but he'd never been good enough. He would always, now and forever, be the dumb nigger who lost the most important thing in his whole worthless life. For hours he paced, roaming the bedroom and adjoining living room slash kitchen slash dining room, turning the television on and off, opening the door to ask the police officer outside if there'd been any news, if he could help. They'd taken his suitcase, taken the clothes he'd been wearing, and the t-shirt and jeans he now wore felt wrong, strange, not his. Nicole called him again. Her flight was boarding in 40 minutes. She'd been calling for an hour, but he hadn't picked up to talk. But suddenly, the silence of the room hurt his ears, and he was desperate to hear the sound of someone else's voice, a voice saying something other than his own internal accusations. When her name flashed across the phone, he answered.
Stop pacing, she said to him.
What are you? But she was talking over him.
Stop pacing. Sit down. Close your eyes. I'm here. Take a deep breath.
He stood in the middle of the room, phone pressed tight to his ear. Tears burned as they slid down his cheeks, and he closed his eyes.
Seriously. Sit down, she said. Listen to me. Take a deep breath.
He sat, the mattress giving beneath him. He tried to breathe, but his lungs no longer breathed air.
You know, I really would have just come to Charlotte, she said. You didn't have to do all this just to see me again. When you want something, you really go for it, you know that?
Despite himself, he released a breath, a strangled guffaw. And suddenly the air was flowing into his lungs again.
Nicole, it's not your fault. You hear me? It's not your fault.
It is.
It's not. Nobody could have taken better care of that fiddle. And you know what else? They'll find it. You're going to get it back. You will. I absolutely believe it.
The tears were coming soundlessly, his breathing ragged. And he closed his eyes against the world, now reduced to the exact size and shape of her voice.
Who's there with you?
She asked.
What do you mean? A bunch of cops. Did you call Janice? Your aunt? Is anyone else coming?
I called Janice. I didn't call the others. I couldn't talk to them.
Not even your Aunt Rochelle?
Especially not Aunt Rochelle.
Why? You should give her a call.
The one person in his fucked up family, besides his grandmother, but he couldn't even think of her, who had faith in him.
I can't, he said. I can't tell her that I lost it. I can't tell her that I failed her and everyone, and most of all, Grandma Nora. Well, what does Janice say?
I don't remember. No, she said she's coming. I think she said she's coming.
I talked to her, too.
She'll be there tomorrow morning.
Oh, yeah.
She told me that she was sure they'd find it, Nicole said. She said that people almost always get it back in a couple days. A week at most, she said. Remember Yo-Yo Ma got his cello back in a couple hours? He'd left it in a cab in New York City.
Oh, he said.
Right. I'll be there in 2 hours, okay?
Okay, he said.
Look, we're boarding. I'll be there soon. Just stay calm. It's not your fault. Ask the police if there's anything else you can do in the meantime. Get some food. Maybe one of the cops brought vegan donuts.
Ha ha, he said without humor. They hung up. The evening folded into night, and a blustery beer-gutted guy in a suit coat that didn't begin to cover his paunch knocked and entered, introduced himself. Bill Soames, head of the FBI's art crime unit. He led Ray through the same questions that the other cops had asked. When was the last time Ray locked the case? He locked it only when the violin was out of his sight, and it hadn't been out of his sight for days. When was the last time Ray had actually seen the violin? A little after 6 p.m., between 6:05 and 6:15, when he'd finished practicing for the day. He'd slid the violin in its case before jumping into the shower and heading out for dinner. Who else had access to the violin? Just Ray. And his girlfriend? Yeah, she was on her way back. She'd be here in an hour. And maybe some of the housekeeping staff, but he was always there when housekeepers came in. Who had a motive to take it? Ray couldn't help thinking, is this guy fucking high? Everyone had a motive, everyone. Did any of these cops even talk to each other? He'd already told this to at least 4 different detectives. And meanwhile, the people who should be investigated, the Marx family for starters, were probably laughing their fat asses off, thinking they got away with it. Black people are so dumb, they were probably saying. For once, he agreed with them. Calm down, the FBI guy said. Ray had already forgotten his name. We're looking into them. I know you're upset. Just know we're doing everything that we can do. Ray knew that whatever they were doing was not enough. If he couldn't protect it, they sure couldn't. For these cops, retrieving a missing violin was just part of the job, like finding a lost dog or a misplaced umbrella. After the guy had left, Ray was too exhausted to even pace. He lay on the bed, hating himself. Just before midnight, Nicole returned, and the police pulled her aside before she could do more than give him a hug. An hour later, she returned to the room. Her skin sticky, dark hair tousled and greasy. Neither showered. It was as if by showering they'd somehow be washing off some last trace of the violin. They lay together on top of the yellow satin hotel bedspread. Nicole held his hand as he stared up at the ceiling. It shone silver and gold in the midtown night. At 3:07 a.m., he told her,
"You know what? I'm rich."
"What are you talking about?"
"When the insurance company pays out. But I guess I'm not that rich because of my family."
"You still won't be poor."
She squeezed his hand.
"It's not your fault. You need to know that. You did everything right."
His own hand was suddenly sweaty, and he pulled free, rubbed his eyes.
"The Marx family is probably partying tonight.
I bet they're playing it right now.
That fucking niece.
What's her name?
Heather?
Heidi? It's Holly, and the Marx family probably has about 80 FBI agents ransacking their house and bank accounts," she said. "I doubt they're partying. They're definitely not getting any sleep tonight either."
"I hope they never sleep again."
He laughed, a harsh guffaw in the dark.
He imagined the violin dropped, damaged. He'd been entrusted with this instrument, this glowing talisman that possessed a sound unlike any other. His audiences drew in a collective breath when he played. Now he imagined it smashed under the wheels of a car, the shards of wood poking out like the feathers of a run-over bird. He went over to the window, pulled the drapes fully closed. Now it was too dark, too stuffy, and he opened them again. The window looked out onto an air shaft.
"Have you even practiced today?" she told him.
"Are you fucking out of your mind?
What am I going to practice with, the fucking bed?"
"Don't be so short-sighted. They're going to find it. In the meantime, you still have a lot of work to do. That Mozart's not going to play itself."
"Nicole, Ray,
we've just got to find you another violin, just until yours is recovered. Unless you want to call and drop out of the competition. Nobody would blame you."
He looked over at her. A shadow lost in shadow.
"You think I should?"
"Should what?
Get another violin?
Fuck yeah, you should.
We're already in New York. Janice is coming. What's the name of the guy that did the appraisal? Mike?"
"Misha Roland."
"Yeah. He could help you find something, just temporarily. They're going to find your violin."
He said nothing, and she went on.
"Ray, you're about to make history. But you can't do it if you don't do it, dumbass. Just get the violin so you have something to practice on while they're getting it back from Holly Marks. Let's call Misha Roland first thing tomorrow. We can do this."
"Can we talk about this in the morning?"
"Okay, but promise me that if your violin isn't back by 10 a.m., we're standing on Misha Roland's doorstep when he opens up."
"I think he opens at 9.
10's fine. Let me sleep in a little, okay? It's almost 4 now," she said. "If I were you, I'd be saying, you need to do this. This is a temporary setback. You're one of the best young violinists in the country, maybe the world. This won't stop you. This is your best opportunity to show everybody who always said you couldn't."
"But Ray, there are no buts. This is it. This is your moment. You grab it.
That violin is amazing, but you're even more amazing. And now you're going to show everybody."
"I'm going to win," he said, "even without the violin. How long will it take the insurance company to pay? Maybe I can get a message to the thieves, tell them I have the money and they can get it back to me early."
"I have no idea,"
she said, putting out her hand in the dark. He took 3 steps toward her, reached out, grabbed the note, held on. Transfer on July 15th between 12 p.m. Eastern Standard Time and 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
"I want you to come with me," he said.
"Of course," she said. Her face was a smooth oval in the half-light.
"I have a good ear for tone, and I think I know what will suit you."
"No," he said. The empty windows across from the air shaft gleamed at him, and he felt almost as if he were falling into them.
"Not to get a violin. But I want you to do that, too. I mean to Moscow. I want you to come with me."
"What?" She sat up.
"Are you serious?"
"I'm very serious. I need you there with me, especially after this. Will you come? Help a brother out?"
"But I have to play," she said.
He could tell from her voice that she was just going through the motions. Her grip tightened on his.
"I can't just take off 3 weeks from work. We're doing that Sibelius retrospective, remember?"
"Nicole, you're coming. We can do this together. I might not have a violin, but I have you.
I think the violin is worth more."
"True. Maybe I can sell you in Russia and use the money to pay the ransom. She slid off the bed and slipped over to him, wrapped her arms around his back. Her face was cool against his cheek. I'm sure I can probably get time off work. He could feel her mind working so close to his. You'd probably have a lot of money left over after you sell me. Yeah, I'm planning on it. So you'll come? I've got to figure out flights. Letting him go and sitting down on the bed, she pulled out her phone, compared various offerings. With his eyes, he traced the nape of her neck, the elegance of her finger as she scrolled across the screen. Her eighth note tattoo flickered almost as if it were a melody. Even after the longest day in creation, she was still beautiful. How could she love someone as damaged as he was? There's actually a flight from Erie that's $493 with a 3-hour layover in Frankfurt, she said. He'd lost his violin, and she was still with him. She still believed in him. How was this possible? 10 minutes later, he lay on the bed and stared up at the ceiling. She kept thumbing her phone, whispering travel options that he only half heard. This one goes through Rome. Oh, but that one has a 24-hour layover. Want to spend a day in Rome? One thing about Nicole, she loved to travel but was stupidly cheap about it. She always looked for the cheapest routes. 20 minutes later, she tucked the phone away. By 5 a.m., her breathing had grown deep and even. He lay there, holding her through the broken remainder of the night, until the ceiling's silver warmed into dawn. Chapter 3. Day 2. Temporary Solution. News of the theft broke sometime around dawn, and by 7 a.m., when Ray next turned on the TV, his face peered out from CNN, Fox, and every other news channel. Underneath talking journalists' heads and shots of the Saint-Jacques' golden-white awning, the theft slid into the Chiron. $10 million Stradivarius stolen from New York City Hotel. Bill Soames had told him the night before not to do media interviews. The FBI would release a statement. They told him that doing an interview could compromise the investigation, and anyway, Ray had no intention of sitting across from Anderson Cooper to explain how he had managed to lose the violin. So, let me get this straight. 2 days ago, you carried your violin in an unlocked case up and down New York's Upper West Side? Do I have that right? Yes, you have that right. Did you take it on the subway? No, only taxicabs and to a couple bars. That's it, swear to God. By 8:15 a.m., his voicemail was full and he had 112 unread texts. He would have turned off his phone entirely, but Soames had said that there could be further communication from the kidnappers, so he needed it on and charged. There will be no further communication. He flipped channels. Turn that off, Nicole said from the bed, eyes still closed. Please? He turned off the TV. Nicole was groggily checking her phone. Hey, Janice texted. She's here. She said you haven't texted her back. Janice Stevens, his violin teacher, mentor, friend, and surrogate mother, had taken the first flight out of Charlotte that morning to be with them. She, more than anyone else in the world, understood what the violin meant to him. He was terrified to see her, afraid that he would read disappointment in her eyes. He'd failed her, too, like he'd failed everyone else. After all the time she'd spent with him, the extra hours she'd wasted, touring over the summer, teaching him how to talk to music directors, I didn't want to talk to her. I'll tell her to meet us at Misha's, okay? It looks like she can be there by 9:15, Nicole groaned. Let's have her meet us there at 10. We both need a shower, and I need to get some breakfast. I bet there's media outside. They're definitely out front, Ray said. We should go out the back.
So I'll tell her 10 a.m. at Misha's? She can call the shop and tell him we're coming.
He felt unable to make decisions, incapable of even nodding assent, so he just shrugged. The news spread. Texts swirled in from his family.
Aunt Rochelle, are you okay? Call me.
Uncle Thurston, why you let somebody steal it? And then his mother.
When you think we get paid?
His lawyer, Kim Wok, called and texted, probably to say, I told you so. No way was he talking to her. Meanwhile, Nicole ordered breakfast.
You've got to eat, she said,
ordering the same food as yesterday. How could it have been only yesterday?
Hope you're not hungry,
she told him when she hung up.
They said it'll be an hour. Let's jump in the shower so we can be ready to go right after we eat.
I'm not hungry, he said. They both showered when someone knocked on the door.
Here's breakfast, Nicole said. I'll get it. I'll get the tip, too. Just don't get used to it.
Ray managed to smile. But it wasn't housekeeping with their eggs. Instead, Bill Soames and another FBI guy whose name Ray couldn't remember came in.
You find it?
Ray asked, standing.
Not yet, but we do have some promising leads, Soames said. Several people from the housekeeping staff didn't show up for work today.
What's promising about a bunch of people skipping work? Ray said.
Maybe the hotel down the street pays better.
Or maybe one of the housekeeping staff knows something about the violin and skipped town, Soames said evenly.
You think so? Nicole said. What makes you think that?
I don't know if I'd want to show up for work if the place was crawling with cops.
Soames shrugged.
Maybe they got something to hide. We're checking their home addresses. We'll keep you posted.
Another knock, and breakfast arrived. Soames and the other agent left. Nicole sat down to eat, and she forced Ray to have a few forkfuls of egg. He felt better. Janice met them just inside the door to Roland's Fine Instruments on 56th Street. She embraced him and would not let him go. Worn from the flight, her black hair grayer than he remembered, she was nonetheless sturdy and solid. He wept in her arms. In the showroom, Misha Roland clasped both of Ray's hands in his enormous ones. The pinned-up violins and violas glared down from the walls. What a traitor Ray was. His bones ached to think of playing some other instrument.
I have treasure for you, Misha said. It will not be what you had, of course not, but it will be special, and it will be worthy of the Tchaikovsky competition.
How did Misha even know Ray had entered the competition?
You know, thanks, guys, but I don't think I can do this, Ray said.
A wave of nausea had swelled up in him. The scrambled eggs burned at the back of his throat.
Let's just go.
Nicole reached for him, but he ducked away, heading back the way he'd come. Every other violin in the entire world was in that showroom, everyone but his. How could he think, even for an instant, that he could replace his violin with something else? These were only glued pieces of wood. Horsehair stretched over Pernambuco, varnished and shining. His violin thrummed in his blood. His violin was not there. He was almost out of the shop when Janice said his name so quietly. But something made him pause. Hand on the front door's worn brass handle.
Ray, this is not your fault, she said.
She didn't raise her voice. But all the days and years of practicing with her made it impossible for him not to hear her.
They're going to find your violin. You have to believe that. We all believe it. Finding a loaner instrument isn't a betrayal. It's just a tool to get you to the next step. It's just too soon, he said.
He could barely get the words out. It's just temporary, Janice said. Once they find your fiddle, you'll return this one. You can make Tchaikovsky sound good playing on a cardboard box with rubber bands.
That's what I was playing when I met you, he said, forcing a laugh.
Outside, three gray-suited men with black briefcases filed down 56th Street. He wished he were one of them. My point is that of all the obstacles you've had to face, you've never backed down. You're not a quitter. You've worked too hard to let some selfish asshole destroy your dreams. It's about the music, remember? It's about what you bring to the music. I didn't want to work with you because of your violin. I wanted to work with you because I'd never seen someone love music so much. You can't lose that. Let's just choose an instrument to practice on so you don't lose everything you've worked for. Okay? The Tchaikovsky competition was less than a month away. He'd given up the last 6 months of his life to prepare for it. He turned back to the room. Misha, expressionless, was holding out a 1959 Lehman, and almost despite himself, Ray took it, smooth and cool. It lay in his hands like a wet fish, glinting. And yet there was a part of him that was relieved, as if some bow hair inside his skull tightened or loosened. This was familiar. This was his world. This was music. He would continue to play. He would continue to connect with his listeners. All this would not be in vain. Ray tuned the layman, lifted into a G scale, then fumbled into Ray Vaughan Williams's Rosamèdre. The opening notes coming almost unwillingly, haltingly. He hadn't played the simple melody for so long, but somehow it always lay there, just beyond the furthest reaches of his hearing. The song he played so often for Grandma Nora, and he played it for her now. The unpretentious tune pouring down and echoing and repeating. Lovely was the word Rosamèdre translated, and he closed his eyes, and for a moment, just let its sweetness wash him clean. And then, somehow, the song was over. The layman's full, ripe sound hung in the air. It had resonance and depth, and a familiarity that Ray immediately liked. But you never go with the first car you drive, so he handed it back to Misha. Next was a 1986 Vitacek, gorgeous and showy, with a sharpness that cut through the air, commanded attention. Holding it felt wrong, though. It was beautifully balanced, but not balanced like his violin had been. It didn't sit quite right under his jaw and looked slightly awkward as he stared down the fingerboard. The 2003 Henner was too tight. No way it would open up enough before the competition. The 1907 Gorman was not bright enough. Finally, with most of the morning gone, Ray turned to Misha.
You knew right off the bat which one I'd like, he said.
The big man smiled, slid the layman across the counter. Ray picked it up.
Great choice, Nicole said. You rock that thing.
20 minutes later, Ray, Janice, and Nicole headed back to the hotel, the layman slung securely over Ray's shoulder in a black Tonarelli case. He wasn't ready to play it, not quite yet, but he felt centered again, having the weight at his back. Bill Soames and the NYPD were tracking down dozens of leads, he told Ray back in the hotel. It sounded promising, but Ray didn't want to let himself hope. That afternoon, as they waited for further news, Tommy Reed, the Benson Insurance Company representative, phoned. Benson was offering a $25,000 reward for information leading to the Strads' recovery. In the meantime, they were sending their own investigator. Although it was too early for them to pay out, it would be at least 6 months, if not longer, before they closed the file and paid the $10 million. They'd already hired a private art detective, Alicia Childress, to investigate the theft. One of the top art recovery experts in the world, she'd cleared her schedule to get started immediately,
given the ransom note's tight deadline.
That's great, Ray said. She's coming to New York?
Tomorrow. I'm warning you. She can be a little brusque, Tommy Reed told him, but she's a total bulldog and smart as hell. The FBI, NYPD, Benson's reward, Alicia Childress. Ray was not alone. All the world was marshaling. Chapter 4. Days 3 through 4. Alicia. Around 9 the next morning, Nicole went shopping.
I'll be back in an hour, she said. I'm just going to get stuff to eat so we don't keep spending this insane money on room service. In the meantime, Mozart's waiting on you.
What? He said, looking up from the game he was playing on his cell phone. He'd slept a couple hours last night, but as soon as he awoke and the Strad's loss drenched him, he lay under the covers, unable to move, wishing that breathing was not automatic and that he could just stop. An hour later, when Nicole awoke, she immediately bounded into action, opening the curtains, ordering breakfast, forcing him to take a shower. Now she was dressed, standing near the door, slipping into sneakers.
Time to practice.
I don't really feel like it, he said, but he knew she was right. The layman lay where he dropped it last night, propped in the corner of the bedroom. He could feel it pulsating there in the dark, the weight of it unfamiliar and a little uncomfortable, like an extra sack of potatoes in his shopping bag. She gave him a long hug. After she'd gone, he trudged over to the layman and stared at the case, as if he expected it to apologize.
Sorry, dude, but I'm all you've got.
So here's what you do if you're a black guy trying to make it work in an unfamiliar world. You just put your head down and do the work. You do twice as much work as the white guy sitting next to you, and you do it twice as often, and you get half as far. But you do it. You just sit down and practice over and over, and eventually someone turns to you and says, "Wow, you're way better than I expected you'd be." And all those extra hours of practice, they build themselves into the marrow of your bones. They electrify the nerve endings on the tips of your fingers until they become habit. Now his bones were pricking, and his fingertips were tingling, and even though picking up this unfamiliar instrument was the very last thing he ever wanted to do, he did it. He'd built that into himself, that discipline, that strength. The layman felt light in his hands, too light. It was someone else's violin. He'd have to relearn the Mozart, the Tchaikovsky, the Ravel, the Bach, and the other pieces, all with someone else's violin. But unexpectedly, the layman felt familiar to him, like the violin he'd had back in high school. He'd made that one sound good, too. Playing that violin hadn't been a betrayal. Playing the layman wouldn't be either. Both were just tools. They were the means of making music. He started with the Mozart, the violin sonata number 21 in E minor, trying Nicole's suggestion of slowing down the second movement. Mozart had written it around the time that his mother had died, and the dark minor key reflected his mourning, and Ray's too. The piece felt like an appropriate way for Ray to begin. He tucked the layman under his jaw and imagined fat little cherubs tiptoeing across clouds, borne up by the music lingering below, jumping from cumulonimbus to cirrus, sunlight slanting through the blue. Nicole was right. Slowing down the tempo meant that the cherubs didn't have to zip around frenetically. They could glide from cloud to cloud, rolling in an upward current of warm air. He didn't even hear her return, but eventually became aware that she was standing in the doorway. Almost 2 hours had disappeared inside the Mozart.
"Wow," she said. "You're doing Mozart proud."
"You're right about the second movement," he said. "Ben Amundsen could take a tip from you."
I'm really feeling it. Sounds like you are, too. Don't get too cocky, son.
She disappeared into the living room, and he lifted the bow again to the layman's strings. An hour later, Bill Soames brought them news.
We checked out one of the people who didn't show up to work yesterday. The woman who brought you breakfast the morning you left.
Hope leaped blindly, like a fish jumping out of a lake.
Where is she?
Ray asked.
We're checking her residence now. Her name is, allegedly, Pilar Jimenez.
A bloom of razor burn coated Soames's neck, and he scratched at it.
What do you mean, allegedly?
Nicole said.
Don't you know her name?
There is a possibility that she didn't provide her real name.
That doesn't make sense. Doesn't the hotel have to get passports, visas, something? Ray said.
Yes, we're reviewing her documents now, Bill said. But there are red flags. It looks like a fake passport. False social security number.
Fake? You're fucking kidding me, Ray said. He wasn't sure if he was furious or elated.
How long has she been with them?
Nicole asked.
Almost 2 months,
Ray said. And you went to her house?
We went to the apartment she listed as her residence, yes. She wasn't there. Nobody would say where she was, only that she left yesterday.
So what are you doing?
We're talking to everyone, checking everywhere she might have gone,
Soames said.
Buses, cars, planes, trains, door to door to the neighbors, her church. We'll find her.
They hashed out various possibilities. That someone had bribed Pilar Jimenez to swap the violin for the Chuck Taylor shoe. That Pilar was maybe a violin aficionado and had targeted the violin herself. That she'd infiltrated the hotel for the express purpose of stealing the violin, since Ray regularly stayed there.
$10 million is a very good motive, Bill said.
Bill Soames drilled Nicole again for her version of the breakfast delivery that morning. Ray had heard the story several times by now. Each time she seemed slightly more broken, her voice even shakier, as if she were reliving the part she may have played in the violin's loss, the fatal mistake of letting the housekeeper out of her sight, if only for a moment. Nicole was sitting in the armchair next to the window when the knock came.
Room service?
She let the small, dark-haired woman in. Nicole didn't really get a good look at her behind the breakfast cart. The woman kept her head down. Her hair was smooth, with straight bangs caught in a bun at the nape of her neck. She pushed the breakfast cart past the bathroom on the left where Ray was showering, past the kitchenette also on the left, into the living room. She'd stopped the cart in front of the small dining room table and started transferring the plates.
I should have stayed right there, Nicole said. I never should have tipped her.
Why didn't you have the tip ready? Bill asked. You knew she was coming. Don't you normally give a tip?
Ray usually does it,
Nicole said, looking at him.
Yeah, Ray said. I do.
But Nicole's purse was in the bedroom, so she went in to retrieve it.
I could still see the cart, she said.
Could you see the woman?
A long pause. She stared at the FBI agent, then down at her hands.
No,
she said finally.
I guess I couldn't.
Could you hear anything?
I heard her moving plates and glasses.
Her voice cracked.
But I wasn't really paying attention. I only had a 20, so I had to find Ray's wallet.
How many plates did you hear her move? Did you hear the violin case open?
No,
she said.
I was looking for Ray's wallet. I just heard him taking a shower.
Tears gleamed in her eyes, and she looked at her hands in her lap. Ray wanted to reach out, grab hers, hug her tight.
So what happened next? Bill said. Did you get his wallet?
Yeah. I found it and got $5.
Where was the wallet? Could you see the cart when you found it?
No, she said, and now Ray could hear the panic in her voice. His wallet, it was on the floor. It fell on the floor, between the nightstand and the bed. I had to look for it. It was maybe 30 seconds, but I found it and gave it to her. Gave her the money.
$5, you said before?
Yeah, Nicole said. It was only 30 seconds.
How did you know where his wallet was?
He always has it on the nightstand. Don't you?
She appealed to Ray.
Yeah, he said. I always put it on the nightstand at night.
But it wasn't there, Bill said to Ray. And then to Nicole. So how did you know to look on the floor? Did you look through his coat first? Anywhere else it maybe could have been?
No, Nicole said. Why would I not look on the floor? Wouldn't you? That's normal. This whole thing is normal. Now her voice was breaking. I went into the bedroom. I came back out. I gave her the money, and she left. That's it.
That's not it, Bill said. Somewhere during that time, the violin disappeared.
Nicole had been inching toward him, as if she could convince him by her proximity, but now she fell back in her chair as if her spine could no longer hold her up.
It was 30 seconds, she repeated. It was a minute.
Was it?
It couldn't have been more than a few minutes. 3, 5 tops.
She probably swapped out the violin in less than a minute, stashed it underneath the cart. It would have taken her seconds. Because the violin, all this time, lay casually in its unlocked case across the chair closest to the wall. The cart would have blocked Nicole's view of it. Ray remembered seeing the violin case there when he went to grab breakfast. He'd been slightly surprised because he usually left it in the bedroom, but the night before they'd all had a bit too much to drink. He'd probably come in, laid the violin on the chair, and collapsed into bed without thinking.
So she had the opportunity to swap the violin for the shoe, Bill Salms confirmed.
For a moment, no one said anything. Nicole sniffed. A tiny sound, but it seemed very loud in the silence.
I'm not saying this is what happened, Bill said, but it seems very possible.
You mean it's my fault?
Nicole said flatly.
I didn't say that.
You're damn right you didn't say that, Ray said. It's not her fault.
It's not a question of fault, Bill said. It's just a question of opportunity. This was an opportunity, and it's possible that the woman took advantage of it.
All the stars must have had to be aligned perfectly in order for her to pull this off, Ray said. Bill Salms shrugged.
You'd be surprised. A lot of crimes really boil down to moments of opportunity. This woman may have been coming by delivering your breakfast a bunch of times with the shoe and the ransom note in her cart. She finally got lucky.
Ray squeezed Nicole's hand. Maybe now his luck would change. He spent the evening practicing, even though it still felt traitorous to be playing the layman. Stradivarius violins were unique. They commanded a mystique unlike any other instrument, with what many believed to be the purest, most extraordinary sound a violin could make. But the power and pull of the violin went well beyond its sound and its beauty. His own violin was in his blood, in the pulse that beat in his wrists and temples. He skipped dinner. The Tchaikovsky concerto blossomed. Just after 8 p.m., the phone buzzed. A woman's voice, firm and no nonsense. Raekwon McMillan? Alicia Childress here. I'm downstairs and I'm coming up. Minutes later, a stout woman in her late 50s or early 60s was shaking his hand. Her curly gray hair was trimmed very close to her skull, and she wore khakis and a loose sweater. Without asking, she moved past him into the suite, pulled out her laptop, cleared a space on the dining room table, talking the whole time. She was done with pleasantries.
So let me make this clear, she said without preamble. I'm focusing on three factors, and I'm going to drill into all of them. Access, forensics, and motive.
He and Nicole sat down across from her. Ray removed Nicole's cup of cold, half-drunk coffee from the table, laid it on the sideboard behind him. Where it had rested on a glass top, a half-moon glared up like a giant, ghostly fingernail.
So my first job, Raekwon, Alicia said, is to determine who had access to the violin. I'm going to start by going over your story, every inch.
Ray said.
What?
Ray, he said. Please call me Ray. Nobody calls me Raekwon.
Ray it is then, she said. I'm still going to go over your story, she told him, and then I'm going to go over yours, she said to Nicole. You both had the most access, obviously.
Pilar Jimenez, Nicole said.
I keep telling everybody it was either my family or the Marx family, Ray said. It had to be one of them.
I've heard this, and I'll get to them in a minute.
Ray twined his fingers with Nicole's. He felt more confident. This woman really was a bulldog. No time to chat and be friendly. Alicia was on a mission, and he was not about to stand in her way. Anything you need.
Second, forensics. The FBI and the Art Squad have already shared everything with me, and I'm in the process of reviewing it. It's unfortunate that you didn't discover the theft until after the crime scene was tainted.
You're assuming the crime scene is the hotel room? Ray said.
I am. But you're right. Since you didn't lock the case, it could have been stolen elsewhere. The airport, the airplane, plus the evening before when you were wandering around the city. Pilar Jimenez is our primary person of interest, of course, but keep in mind that no matter where the violin was stolen, we still have a tainted crime scene.
What about the ransom note? Ray put in. Are you tracking down the Bitcoin account? Alicia's brown eyes were carefully blank.
Yes, we're all working on tracking down the account.
What about the letter itself? Ray asked.
Waiting to hear back from the lab for fingerprints or any other DNA. But honestly, I wouldn't hold out much hope for that. Whoever planned this did it very carefully, and I doubt he left his fingerprints or a saliva sample on the paper.
What about tracking down the ink and the paper? Nicole said.
Alicia didn't look away.
Already did. It's from an HP office jet 5258 using standard HP black ink. HP has sold 14,000 of the printers over the last year. The lab is still analyzing the paper, but I'll tell you right now that it's from a cheap ream that you can pick up in any office supply store in the country. The physical note itself is a dead end.
The shoe, Ray said. The shoe is the key. It's got to be a clue. Did you find out Dante Marx's shoe size? I'll bet you it's a 10.5.
He wears a size 9. Alicia told him. And in the meantime, there were 300 purchases of men's size 10.5 chucks in the tri-state area over the past month, and another 200 online across the U.S. We're tracking down everyone we can, but it's a monumental job.
Oh, Ray said.
The third factor I'm focusing on is motive, she went on, holding his gaze. Who would want it? Is it for some black market collector? Is it for the insurance money?
She eyed Ray, sizing him up. He stared right back.
The people with the biggest motive are my family, he said. They have the most to gain.
He didn't want to explain again about the deal he'd made with them. How his lawyer had begged him not to. How he thought it was his only option. And if it isn't them, it's those crazy Marxists. It has to be. She nodded, not asking for details yet. She clearly already knew.
Yes, when it comes to motive, they all have a strong one.
She paused, her eyes drifting beyond him, staring at the blank cream wall of the hotel suite.
And you need to know that we're looking into you closely. The insurance money makes you a pretty obvious suspect.
If he wanted to sell it, he would have sold it already, Nicole said.
I've certainly had offers, Ray said, for more than 10 million bucks. Someone offered me 14 a couple weeks ago.
That's good to know, Alicia said. I'll want a list. In the meantime, I'll start with you, she said to Ray. It was now after 9 p.m. Despite the lateness of the hour, Alicia asked Nicole to go into the bedroom, close the door. Then she spent the next 2 hours grilling Ray about every movement he'd made the day of the theft. The FBI guys and the police detectives had been polite and thorough, but this woman took it to a whole new level, drilling into every step of the evening and night. When you went to the bathroom, you took the violin with you?
Yes.
Number one or number two?
The night before it was stolen, only number one.
Where was the violin?
Slung over my right shoulder, in its case.
You never took it off?
Never, especially not in the bathroom. Humidity. It stays on my shoulder.
How about if you have to go number two?
I always find a stall that has a hook on the inside of the door so I can hang it. Always within arm's reach.
Always?
Always, he said firmly. Okay, let's get this out of the way. I'm just some black dude who got lucky. I know what you're thinking, but I never do anything to put my violin at risk.
I can see that.
She nodded.
But the case wasn't locked when you were having dinner, right? Or drinks? Or in the cab?
No.
Why not?
Because I don't lock it when I have it on me. And I always have it on me.
So you never lock it, you're saying?
I've locked it, Ray said defensively.
Mm-hmm.
Alicia looked down at her notes.
But it wasn't locked when you were in the shower, right? When the housekeeper was in the room?
He just looked at her. She was right.
I don't think you get it,
Ray said.
I don't take any risks with it.
Ever. I never leave it alone. I don't walk around with the case unlocked and leave it lying on a park bench. That violin is my life. It changed everything for me.
From what I've heard, you're a very talented musician in your own right.
He shrugged, still feeling a little defensive. It took my playing to a whole different level. It was an enormous shortcut to having people pay serious attention to me.
Nothing good is ever easy, she said.
I guess not. But I don't come from a family that really nurtures music.
Not even now, with all the attention you've gotten. You certainly are a media darling these days.
No, not even now. I haven't talked to my mom in months.
Really?
Alicia said.
Why is that?
She did everything she could to stop me from playing. She just wanted another paycheck coming in.
Was she hurting for money?
He shrugged. I didn't think so. But she was a single mom, and I have a younger brother and sister, and they always need something. It's worse because they're twins and she has to buy for both of them. She's always wanting more money. He thought about it. But honestly, I have no idea. You think my mom would steal my violin?
Do you?
I don't know. My family has the best motive, but I really don't think they'd be able to get away with it. Not with all the conditions we put around the deal. My lawyer made sure of that. They're definitely greedy, but they wouldn't have the slightest idea of how to pull something like this off. Getting $50 worth of groceries for 15? Yeah, sure. But this? Not even.
There's a lot of money at stake, Alicia said. You'd be surprised what a motivating force money can be.
Where Ray's mother was concerned, Ray thought, Alicia Childress didn't know the half of it. Alicia pulled her laptop over, donned a pair of reading glasses.
Some of those relatives of yours have racked up some serious debts, she was saying. Thurston and Joyce in particular.
They always wanted money from me, he said. I never made very much, but I still sent them what I could. It was probably $20,000 all told. But it was never enough.
Which is why you made that deal with them back in February, she said.
Yeah, he said. That's why. It got them off my back.
She'd been studying her laptop as if she could read some hidden map in its screen, but now she looked up at him, shook her head. Your family is at the top of my list of suspects. A stolen violin plus insurance money equals a big, fat, life-changing motive.